Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Donald Stern, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District, again with us this morning. Dr. Stern, always good to talk to you. Good morning.
Good morning, Ted. Hope you're doing well today.
I am doing well. You sound as though you're doing well, and we continue on.
Yes. Let's talk about COVID-19. What do you say?
Yeah, I think so. I've got a couple of questions or two for you. As far as the numbers go, it's interesting looking at the numbers, because we are seeing an increase in the number of positive cases each day. The other day it was something like 45, and yesterday was 38, and so those numbers are a little bit higher than we've seen.
That's correct. The number of positive COVID-19 cases seems to be on the uptake right now, at least for the last week. You know, prior to that, Ted, as we've discussed, it had been coming down for over a month-long period. From the beginning of June, it dropped down, but the last week, the numbers seem to be going up. So, yeah, it was, I think, 46 cases reported in one day yesterday. So in general, we are seeing these increasing trends, and it may reflect, we wonder whether it reflects what people were doing on the 4th of July, much more interaction,
yeah,
much more activity, vacationing, people having the virus, having more opportunity to transmit from person to person. You know, in early July, we had several days in which the cases were less than 10 a day. Now it's creeping back up. So the good news is hospitalizations remain low. That is, the number of people in the hospital still remains less than 20. But we do anticipate that might start increasing. Usually hospitalizations lag a little bit behind the uptake in number of cases. But we'll keep a good eye on it. Of course, the key number for me is the hospitalizations, because that implies who's really getting sick from this disease. Otherwise, COVID-19, most people tolerate it fairly well.
So, but I guess as we go on, I guess this is something you continue to look at, because I mean every day. I mean you have taught me to look at that. When I receive the report from your office every day, I always at first zero in on the hospitalizations, and like you say, that has stayed. I think 13 is where we've been just about all week.
Yes, that's right.
It's interesting. I went to the dentist for the first time in a number of months this past week, and got a temperature check to get in. I was number of questions they asked me, and they asked me where I had traveled over the last couple of weeks. That was the first time I've encountered the temperature checks at a number of places, but this was the first time I was asked, you know, if I had left the area and where I had gone.
Well, a number of healthcare providers do also have been asking those types of questions, and not just checking temperature, but checking, asking about any symptoms, as well as travel. And of course, the interest there is travel to hot spots. Would it make any difference whether they'd let you in the door or not if you and I said that, yeah, we just got back from New York? Or
I know. I wondered. I wondered that. They never answered my question.
Yeah. What would they do if you said yes?
Yeah, I had that. I did have that same question. But I mean, this all goes back, and you mentioned most people who get COVID-19 handle it well, and you always talk to us about the fact that this is endemic. We're not going to be able to box it in, and we've got to learn to live with it.
That's right. At least for the next 6 months, as we've discussed, the vaccine is under development now. There's over 100 companies around the world who are working on developing a vaccine. I believe I sent you a copy of the Bloomberg Business News article that gave a very nice overview of this researcher at Oxford University who, you know, and I want to encourage people about this. People say, well, gosh, they're rushing this vaccine through, so I don't know if I want to get it, whether because we don't really know what we're getting because it was rushed through the development process. You know, a lot of folks who are working on these vaccines have years and years of studying experience with the coronaviruses. For example, this researcher at Oxford University, she'd been working for, I think, a couple of decades on coronaviruses, particularly MERS and SARS, the Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome and the severe respiratory syndrome, both which were coronaviruses. One popped up in 2002, and the other one, MERS, popped up in Saudi Arabia in 2012. Both really bad bugs. I mean, these were coronaviruses that caused severe disease in whoever got them. It wasn't limited to the elderly, wasn't limited to those who were medically challenged. But, you know, MERS, for example, had a 35% mortality rate. So three to four folks out of 10 who got that coronavirus died. This coronavirus, for the most part, is very well tolerated, but it is a disease of the elderly and those with underlying medical conditions. You know, Ted, I was a bit surprised that our schools are not opening right now. I thought, well, you know, what's the concern here? Children handle this disease very well. You know, in the United States, there's only been 36 deaths to children less than 15 years of age. In the nation, where we've had 130 over, okay, this is the CDC data.
Yeah.
As of, I think, about 2 weeks ago. So at that time, they had about 130,000 deaths nationwide. Out of those, 36 of them were to children less than 15 years of age.
Well, I did not realize that.
Children, yeah, but children in that age group had experienced 12,000 deaths, of course, from a number of other disease conditions, conditions of the newborn and the perinatal period, injuries and accidents, motor vehicle incidents, so on and so forth, cancer, so on and so forth. But so out of the 12,000 deaths, over that time period, to children less than 15 years of age, 36 of them were to children who suffered from COVID-19. And my guess is I don't know if I could dive down into the data, whether it's available, but I would almost assure you that those deaths were due to to children who had some underlying severe medical condition.
Yeah.
So, you know, and oh, at the same time, there were over 100 deaths of children less than 15 due to influenza. So what's the big concern? Their fear is continuing to drive our approach. I am concerned. It's not, I've not been that concerned about children, except for those with underlying medical conditions, that those kids ought to stay home. But otherwise, let's go back to work. Let's go back to school. It may be that the concern is more for the teachers, particularly those who may be older teachers, and this may be driving our school education policy right now, is the teachers rather than our care for the children. And, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics made it clear how beneficial it is for children to be back in school. And I will continue to encourage that. And, you know, for those teachers who are elderly or have underlying medical conditions, there are probably opportunities in the schools to find work options for them. They could be the teachers that do the virtual education. Mm-hmm. For those children that need to stay at home, somebody still has to organize those curriculums, provide that support, that training. There are other ways to do this, but you know, this is what we're dealing with. I am concerned that fear may and anxiety still may be driving some of our policy approach.
When school was even getting out and we started talking about this, you had said you thought, you know, educate the parents about this, but the kids need to, and kids can go back. You have said that consistently.
Right.
Dr. Donald Stern, you're the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. Got a couple other questions for you as we deal with schools. We'll talk about, last week you gave us a real good, a comprehensive list of, you know, who shouldn't go as far as kids go while COVID-19 is out there. We'll talk about that when we come back. Need to take a quick break. We'll be back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. Got a question for today's guest? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Donald Stern with us this morning, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District, as we talk about COVID-19. We were talking about schools a second ago, Dr. Stern. And last week you gave us a pretty comprehensive list of there are a lot of students with certain conditions that shouldn't be in school at this time. And I'm hoping you have that list with you again.
I do, Ted. But let's first of all note that, again, most children will handle this disease very well. In fact, they're most likely to be, 50% at least, are going to be asymptomatic with this disease, which means they don't even have any symptoms. The issue is that if they have the disease, then who do they take that disease to?
Yeah.
So part of the concern, of course, from a community perspective would be who do they take that disease home to? So it gets a little bit complex when you think about, well, let's just keep the children with this list that we're going to go through, medical challenging diseases that put them at risk for having a more severe form of the disease. Let's just keep them home. But then all the children, many of them are going to have other folks at home who then may be at risk for severe disease as well, you know?
Yeah.
A grandmom with congestive heart failure, you know, who may be living at home or are actually taking care of those children. But those children or those medical conditions that do place children at higher risk are any form of cancer and, of course, cancer chemotherapy, chronic kidney disease. And by the way, the CDC has updated their list. So it's now more evidence-based, this list I'm giving to you. That is, there is some research done to show that these are the kids that are showing up with more severe forms of COVID-19. So cancer, chronic kidney disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or any kind of immune-compromised state. So I talked about being on cancer chemotherapy, which frequently will compromise the immune system. But there are other types of diseases that are genetic in form that causes an innate immune compromise condition. And kids who have organ transplant frequently are on immune suppressive drugs. Interesting, those who are obese, that is, have a body mass index of 30 or higher, are at higher risk. Serious heart conditions, and you know, this list is a comprehensive list of all folks. So, you know, when we talk about serious heart conditions, we're generally talking about the elderly who have coronary artery disease or congestive heart failure. But there are some children who have serious heart conditions that may be at risk. Sickle cell disease and type 2 diabetes. And I found that kind of curious. Why type 2 diabetes instead of type 1 diabetes?
Yeah.
Type 1 diabetes is on the second list. That is the list that the CDC would say these children might be at increased risk And part of this, Ted, is just the research. Again, the CDC is trying to be data-driven with this list of recommendations. So that list I just gave you, there's research evidence that shows these children are at risk. But I'm guessing partly that kids with type 1 diabetes are generally those kids that parents know, and these kids are being monitored. They're being watched carefully. They have their primary care physician and their endocrinologist who's on them, and they're monitoring their disease closely. Kids with type 2 diabetes may not even know they've got it yet.
Yeah.
So those are the kids that may be less controlled. And we know for these diseases that it's generally those kinds of those kids who are not well controlled that might be at increased risk. So that's our list of kids that we think, but everybody else, go to school, you know, it's going to be okay. But people may just feel too anxious about this and want to wait for 6 months and then get a vaccine. But then you know what we're going to talk about in 6 months from now is the fear of the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, so when are we ever going to get over this? We were talking about vaccine development earlier, and I'm very encouraged by the work of these some of these vaccine developers. For example, the one we talked about last week from Oxford University, this researcher has been working with coronaviruses for decades, particularly SARS and MERS. And so she was she and her team were very familiar with coronaviruses, how they react, how you might work with the virus to manipulate it to create a vaccine, because she was working on a vaccine for both of those diseases. And then COVID-19 pops up. Well, gosh, she was ready to rock and roll. So there's a lot of science already in development about the nature of these viruses so that they could begin their research specifically targeting COVID-19 to develop that vaccine. At the same time, they're working with vaccine manufacturers and then vaccine distributors around the world to make this vaccine available. So I'm pretty confident that we'll have a vaccine towards the end of this calendar year.
Well,
and that will be a safe vaccine as well.
Yeah, and like you say, that then is going to be is going to have to be something that is sold to people, just because you're right. I hear all around people that I know that say those very things. It can't possibly be safe. It's never been done this quickly before. But you look at the technology and just what you just talked about some of the people that are involved have been studying coronaviruses a long time.
Right. And they're still required, at least for vaccines that would be used in the United States, are still required to do phase 1, 2, and 3 of human studies on these vaccines. The limitation of the research, though, is when you do when you get into phase 3, which means 100,000 folks get this vaccine, and then we look at the immune response and the level of protection over a period of time. That's what you need time for. Is the vaccine still protective 6 months out, 1 year out?
Yeah,
we're not going to have that data. But we will have the data that with the vaccine, we do have an immune response, and that's reasonably protective over at least a short period of time. So the idea is to stop this outbreak, and we could do that by achieving a high rate of herd immunity for a period of time.
Going back to schools real quick, Dr. Stern, you had talked about through the spring and now into the summer about getting parents ready to send their kids back to school. Most of the school districts have said that they're going to at least be virtual for the first 9 weeks. I guess, again, schools and there can be an education to parents and students and teachers, and perhaps after 9 weeks there can be a loosening up of things.
Well, I'm frankly not sure what the difference is between the regular beginning of the school year time period versus 9 weeks later. What difference does it make? What are we going to learn during that 9-week period that's going to add to the evidence or data that we need in order to make a decision to open up schools.
Yeah. Yeah, we will see. Well, and I know you've been working a long time, and your staff has worked with each of the school districts. So this kind of caught me by surprise, because I had thought that there would be some kind of at least partial opening to get things started.
Well, again, I think people remain concerned, and I think there's concern for the teachers in particular. And so, these are very difficult decisions that the superintendents have to make. And some of the variables, Ted, that need to be made aren't just infectious disease-related concerns. There are many complex issues I'm sure the superintendents and their staff are having to deal with around just the educational format and venue, and how you make sure that the curriculum is delivered in a complete form over this particular period of time, much less just things, simple things like, wait a minute, okay, we open up the schools, we fill up the schools with teacher staff and students, then we IPNI it out, and at night, the recommendations are to clean contact surfaces throughout the school.
Yeah,
that's a huge commitment of staff and cleaning solution cost every night.
Yeah,
so. I'm sure that those cost factors are weighing in these regards. So this is not an easy decision for our superintendents and their team. I do encourage them to we've tried to help them not make these decisions based on people's fears, but base it on the science evidence. And I think the recommendations that we developed are based on the science. I think we're in good standing in those regards. But again, here, how do we deal with anxiety and fear? But to give more information, and so that's why I've encouraged not just meetings with the staff, but also the schools need to talk with parents before the school year starts about coronavirus. The nature of this disease, and what the schools are doing to prepare for opening, and what they're going to do if there is and when there is a child with COVID-19 or a teacher with COVID-19 that they know of that's been in the school. We know that's going to happen because this virus is endemic. So that the schools had to be prepared to be able to respond then in an appropriate manner without just throwing up their arms in fear and saying, close the school, close. We're not going to do that. That's not necessary.
And I do know that several of the superintendents have talked about the fact that they were concerned that they didn't have any data from any school in the United States that had reopened. So they were concerned about that, just that they didn't want to be the guinea pig.
Huh. Well, that's an interesting point, though. Did we not have any evidence from when this outbreak began? To tell you the truth, I'd have to go back and look at were there school systems that remained open during that time period?
Yeah.
And what happened?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Donald Stern here, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. We need to take a break. We will continue on this morning on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It is now 8:32.
This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg, the financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. Miss an episode of Town Talk? No problem. Just subscribe to the Town Talk podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Music. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Donald Stern in this morning, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. Dr. Stern, we did talk about this, but I'll have you just touch on it for a second. A listener has just texted in and asked, can school children infect grandparents and parents? And you talked about that a few minutes ago, that is one of the concerns.
Well, sure they can. Think about, remember how the disease is transmitted. no matter what age you are, if you have the virus in your respiratory tree, in your nose, mouth, throat, bronchi, you can admit that virus and transmit it to other people. So, yes, school children who are infected can bring it home and transmit it to parents or other folks in their home.
And that is
it works both ways, though. You know, folks who are at home who have the disease can give it to their children, who then can take it to school. So that's why we ask for folks, don't send your kids to school when they're sick. Teach them how to wear a mask. Teach them how to wash their hands frequently during the day. Teach them how to social distance. You know, these are the routine measures that we know work in preventing the spread of communicable disease, in particular COVID-19.
And I have heard, when we talk about, you know, not going to work or, you know, go to school when you're sick, that even with a lot of businesses checking temperatures and all, that there you're starting to hear cases of people wanting to go to work and, you know, I'm sure it's nothing or I can work through this, that's become a concern again. And again, this all goes back to the fact this is endemic and we can't let our guard down.
Well, Ted, that's been an issue from the very beginning of this outbreak, is folks showing up to work who are mildly symptomatic and thinking they could just work through this, sometimes not even thinking about COVID-19. You know, oh, it's just my allergies or I got a simple cold. Because for many folks, this disease can be very subtle in the beginning and not even think much of it. In fact, the whole disease process might simply, for many folks, be like a cold. Well, guess what? They've got COVID-19, and people should not be going to work with symptoms. However, you know, when you have no other source of income and you're not getting paid if you're not at work, mm-hmm. there's this compelling debate in your head about, well, what do I do? You know, go to work and I'm a little sick, or and not pay for food and take care of my family. You know, these are challenging times for folks.
Speaking of challenging times, you and your staff have been working with the assisted living retirement centers in the area the whole time. Hughes Home in Fredericksburg has come up in the past week as the latest example of where there have been a number of cases at Hughes Home.
That's true. A number of residents and staff have turned positive for COVID-19 at Hughes Home. We've been working with them from the beginning to identify those residents and staff to provide guidance in regards to isolation and quarantine, segregating those ill residents, and segregating the staff so that they're not mixing with different types of residents. So that, for example, your staff who are taking care of your COVID-19 positive patients only take care of those patients. And, you know, our long-term care facilities have been fairly responsive. I will tell you that you've seen across the country where in cases where there's an outbreak. Ted, this is another one of those groups of, I would call, hidden heroes.
Yeah.
Those folks who go to work knowing that there's some risk. But if they understand the infectious disease process, know how to use their protective equipment, can work in a safe manner, continue to provide care for their patients. So I kind of honor those dedicated staff who go to work and take care of their patients. Many of our long-term care facilities are doing exactly what need to be done and should be complimented for taking the steps necessary to preserve life, prevent spread of disease in their facilities. Think about it. Long-term care facilities, we've got the elderly. Well, let's see. That's the high-risk group for COVID-19.
Yep.
And we've got people with underlying medical conditions. So combined in a congregated living. So these are really hot spots and at risk for COVID-19. It's very important for us to be, for us, and I'm talking about the facility administrators, their staff, being on top of this and being very mindful of the risk of COVID-19 in their facility. But, you know, with dedicated staff, that many of these facilities are doing symptom checks on their staff as they walk in the door. Well, there's, you know, we're talking about CDC guidelines, so they should be doing that. They've adjusted to wearing personal protective equipment, which they haven't had before in many of these facilities. They're setting up their COVID-19 units, that is segregating their residents so that those who have COVID-19 are in one wing, those who may be at risk or have had a high-risk contact with COVID-19 are in another unit, and then all the other residents are in another unit. Many of them have prepared in advance and are doing periodic testing to identify cases amongst their residents and their staff. And nurses at these facilities are now conducting the testing in their facilities themselves. This is a fairly simple sample collection, but the nursing staff hadn't done that before. Now they're learning how to do that and starting to do that themselves. So accolades to long-term care facilities who are doing it right and staying on top of it and employing these infection control measures with integrity and with discipline.
And discipline is the word you have used throughout this. I was waiting for you to say it this morning, because when we've talked about this, you have talked about discipline and the ones that have done that, like you say, have controlled it, and the ones that haven't, we have seen some pretty big numbers.
Well, you know, once it gets in a facility, it can really just take off. And so the third axiom of infection control measures is not just integrity and discipline, but timeliness. You really got to jump on top of this to stop the spread of disease inside a facility. And if you're not right, don't get right on top of it, it could get ahead of you fairly quickly. So we're working closely with our facilities, and folks are being responsive and doing their best to try to prevent disease in our community and in their facilities.
Dr. Donald Stern here, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. We have to, when we get together, we have to talk about masks. We can't go a show without talking about masks, and they continue to be. It's sometimes breathtaking to see just some of the arguments that the people and the anger they have about wearing a simple mask, but it's still out there, and if anything, it's just the anger of it continues to grow, unfortunately.
Well, you're right, and I don't know if you realize you just said it can be breathtaking.
Yes.
No pun intended. I mean, this is one of the things people will tell you. It's that I can't breathe.
Yeah.
I'm not getting oxygen, or I'm getting a buildup of carbon dioxide.
Yep.
None of the studies on mask use would support that. I mean, would support that they're uncomfortable. Sure. In a hot setting, these masks can become uncomfortable. And if you have to wear it all day long, my grandson is a grocery store shelf stalker. His employer requires him to put on the mask when he comes in the store, and
yeah,
those staff have to keep them on all day, whether people are around them or not, which I would have some debate with. But so he has to wear this mask all day, and he's working. I mean, you know, lifting, moving stuff, stocking shelves. This is fairly labor intensive, and so he's generating body heat, and he's got this mask on, and it's uncomfortable. But so my response to him, my guidance to him was, don't let your discomfort overcome the value of you protecting your coworkers and your customers in the store from you transmitting disease to them. You can take a little bit of discomfort or inconvenience, it's okay. I too am and somewhat taken aback by these arguments that are fairly soft about my own inconvenience or my own discomfort for the sake of protecting my customers or my coworkers. And, let's put on our masks for 6 months. You know, we'll have a vaccine. We'll get through this, not have all these demands on us. And I also say, I put on my mask not because the government is telling me I should put on a mask.
Mm-hmm.
I put it on because I see the value of my protecting other people that I'm around. So do it for that reason. Don't do it because someone's telling you you have to. Do it because you have an interest in taking an interest in the needs of others first.
There's also been the argument this week that I have seen where some of the sports leagues have talked about the fact wear your mask so we can have NFL or college football this fall, and I've thought maybe that'll work use that because but you're right. I was in the store the other day and it's kind of hit and miss. Some days you see a lot of people with them, even though you're supposed to have them, but other times you don't. And you just wish that is not the issue that it's become.
Right. It's a reasonable measure. I know we didn't pursue this initially, but with the increasing evidence, the value of masks to prevent you who may be asymptomatic with the disease and then therefore can transmit the virus to others, it prevents you from transmitting the disease to others. That evidence is very clear. There's good research on that. And it's a sound measure for us to do for others.
And like you say, if you're walking down the street, there have been times when I've been walking down Caroline Street downtown, and there's nobody within sight or within a couple of blocks. I'll take it off, and when I start getting close to someone else, just put it right back on.
Sure, right. I mean, for outdoors, it's less necessary. If you're social distance, it's less necessary. It's most valuable when you're indoor and you're in close proximity to others. And the value of social distancing, washing hands, wearing the mask, all are additive to help prevent the spread of this disease. And that's what the goal is, to prevent, suppress the spread of this disease so that we have less disease, less opportunity for the elderly and those with underlying medical conditions to get the disease. And then make sure that those are the folks that are first in line when we have a vaccine available.
Well, and we, about a month ago, in our offices here, it was mandated that when you walked around the office, when you were at your desk, you didn't have to have it. But if you moved around anywhere in the building, wear a mask. It took a little getting used to, but now it's just second nature to always have that mask nearby.
I think you see it much more these days. I see many more masks in many venues today than I was a month ago. So I think people are starting to get used to it, even though this hot weather is uncomfortable.
Yep. Well, you were the one who first at the very beginning in the spring talked about how when you'd get up and get dressed in the morning, you put on a tie and you put on your mask and wore it. It was part of what you wore to work every day.
That's right, and people may need to be mindful that, if the mask that you have is uncomfortable, try a different mask.
Hmm.
This past week, I had not picked up my mask. It was in the wash, so I'm out the door with an N95. Now, this wasn't a regular N95. This is the N95 Plus.
Ooh.
So it's the construction, the contractor form of the N95 that is a little thicker, a little bit. The mask itself is a little harder. It's designed to prevent from certain chemicals even coming through the mask. And they're designed to protect the individual, not to protect others who you're around. Well, I found that really uncomfortable. And I was telling my staff about this, and they said, oh, we have the mask for you. And they had some masks that were manufactured locally, made out of this very soft cotton material. It was wonderful.
Huh. Yeah. Huh. Right. You're right, though, because all masks aren't created equal. I've gotten some masks, and they aren't. I mean, I've gotten some from a couple of businesses, and I said, oh, I'll wear those, and I've put it on, and I thought, oh, this is too tight. This is, you know, it's too hot.
Right.
So, yeah, find one. If you don't like what you've got, find one that you do like.
Get another one. Right.
Yeah.
And masks are abundantly available now, and you could even find surgical masks, and surgical masks are pretty comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, just wear it and don't complain. That's one of our messages today. Dr. Donald Stern here, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. We'll wrap this up when we come back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg. The financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. You can weigh in about today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubert.
Dr. Donald Stern, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District here this morning. Before we get out of here, Dr. Stern, any changes with the CDC guidelines? Because I know there's always adjustments and changes there.
Oh, we're always having updates and changes in the CDC guidelines. But, Ted, there have been some recent changes which profoundly affect our work and our advice and guidance to folks with COVID-19. Most recently, it's when do you get to come out of isolation? So if you've had COVID-19 disease and you're being treated for that, when can you come out of isolation? Well, the guidelines have changed now. So it's 10 days since the onset of symptoms and 24 hours of fever free. It was 3 days prior. It was 3 days without fever. They've shortened that now to the CDC has shortened that to 24 hours fever free and the symptoms improving. And I'm sure this is evidence-based. This is based on their research of COVID-19 and when people no longer can transmit the disease. So the ending of isolation has changed and most profoundly by reducing the time period in which you're fever-free from 3 days to 24 hours.
I guess this is part of just learning more about the disease.
Right. And also that they've downplayed even much more the test-based strategy to end isolation. Some people think you have to have a test to come out of isolation. No, these symptoms-based strategies work well even for those patients in the hospital, in long-term care centers, or wherever. If you're isolated at home, these are sound guidance now. And using a symptoms-based strategy rather than a test strategy is reasonable. And we don't need to overwhelm our laboratories anyway. They're too busy right now. So those are the major changes.
Okay. Well, we usually end with reviving our community, but we have no time left. And so I guess the best way to revive our community is put a mask on and wash your hands and social distance. I guess those are the biggies.
And everyone, yeah, everyone can take a part in preventing the spread of this disease and preserving life in our community. It's just not the hospital, not just the health department. Everybody can take part in this process.
Dr. Donald Stern, the acting director with the Rappahannock Area Health District. Dr. Stern, thank you so much. We'll talk again.
Thank you, Ted.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by Deakin Wealth Management in Fredericksburg. The financial firm that specializes in providing comprehensive advice for your serious money. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.